Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. President Donald Trump yesterday signed into law a coronavirus relief and spending package bill averting a partial government shutdown. The delay resulted in a temporary lapse of unemployment benefits for approximately 14 million Americans. We'll get the details on the $900 billion package. And meanwhile, the COVID-19 cases continue growing across the country, and the nation could see a spike in the next few weeks after the holidays. We'll discuss those stories and more. National political news. It's all next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Yesterday, after days of mixed messaging in which he called the COVID-19 stimulus package a disgrace, President Trump signed the relief bill, which, among other things, provides a $600 stimulus check. This lame duck period of Donald Trump's one-term presidency has allies and critics wondering what could happen next. In Trump's last few weeks in office, he has vetoed a defense spending bill, pardoned a number of loyal supporters, including his daughter-in-law's father-in-law, and continued to argue that the November election was fraudulent. We're going to talk with Washington, D.C. journalist Ron Elving of NPR joins us, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk. Welcome, Ron.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Good to have you with us. Also good to have Kimberly Atkins with us of the Boston Globe. She's senior opinion writer for the Globe. Good morning, Kimberly Atkins.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Anna Edgerton, who is a Bloomberg editor and reporter. Welcome, Anna Edgerton.
Great. Thanks to be here.
Glad to have you all aboard, and happy holidays to all. And what are you, our listeners, thinking about the federal stimulus bill? What do you think of Trump's pardons and actions in his final days in the White House? You can give us a call now. We invite you to do that at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Number again for your calls, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Let me begin, Ron Elving, with you. And let's begin just by talking about the fact that the president has signed a bill which he said he wouldn't sign after close to a week's delay, and we've got the $2.3 trillion omnibus bill. It's in.
That's right. It's quite a package. The president got in 18 holes in about $2.3 trillion yesterday, so quite a big Sunday. The president had said again and again it was a disgrace. He separated himself from the bill, despite the fact that it had been negotiated in his name by the Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin. The president hung Mnuchin out to dry and said the package was a disgrace, even though Mnuchin was calling it a fabulous package. So it was a curious week between Christmas and today. We just have tried and tried to understand what the president was trying to do, especially in the midst of a holiday week. He got nothing. He will send some rescissions to Congress, which will delay the spending for a month and a half, but not change it. It's not going to go anywhere in the House. That is the rescissions. So this bill is not going to change in any way because of the president's unhappiness. And he merely put his unhappiness, whatever its causes and sources, on display for a past week.
Well, we should all talk about what's in the bill, but also let's talk first, if we could, about what's not in the bill. Aid to state and local governments and liability protection for businesses, but also unemployment lapsed. A couple of unemployment benefits lapsed, affecting 14 million people. So those are going to be delayed, aren't they?
Yes, they are going to take a few more days to get in place. One hopes that there will be enough forbearance that people can get that money a few days later and still be able to use it to pay their bills. Now, one of the big things that's in the bill also is an extension of the federal ban on evictions. Many states have longer bans on evictions, but the federal ban was expiring this week with December 31st. So it was important to get that back on the books and keep millions of Americans from facing eviction at the end of this year.
And we should say there's about $13 billion that's been allocated for food assistance and $7 for increase in broadband access, but also more money for PPPs for small businesses and $25 billion in rental assistance.
Yes, one of the things that was driving the bill on the Republican side in the Senate, where they are the majority, was a concern for various damage, forms of damage that have been done to businesses, particularly small businesses. That is a strong source of support for Republicans. And so they were looking for, among other things, liability protection. And they were holding out on state and local government assistance in exchange for getting the liability protection. And Democrats felt that some of that protection for businesses was going to be inimical to the interests of workers and consumers. And they felt that that could not be brought in, as you were, as a hostage. And as it were, as a hostage, and they wanted to make sure that they would get that out of there if they weren't going to get state and local. Now, I suspect both state and local and some version of liability protection will be back with us as soon as the new House and Senate go into session in January.
Talking with Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News, and Anna Edgerton, a Bloomberg editor, is also with us, who covers Congress for Bloomberg. And Anna, it looks like today, in fact, Speaker Pelosi is going to try to push for what the president said was more in the interest of the American people. He wanted a $2,000 check rather than a $600 check, which he called measly. Interesting to me, the irony of that, when the president paid $700 in taxes. But that's unlikely to get through to the Senate. I mean, it will get through the House probably, but it certainly seems like Mitch McConnell and the Republicans are not in favor of boosting that to $2,000.
That's right. And this is something that the House was already planning to do. You know, they had tried to do this by unanimous consent on Christmas Eve, and Republican leaders blocked it. So the vote that they're doing today is going to be a roll call vote that, under the procedure they're using, would need two-thirds support to pass, which makes me think that they do expect to get some Republican support for the bill. However, it is unlikely to even be taken up in the Senate in its current form. Most likely thing that we'll look for in the Senate is that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell would, you know, maybe try to combine this bill increasing the checks to $2,000 with some of the other provisions Trump had said that he wanted to see, including reform to liability protections for social media companies, which has nothing to do with the liability protections related to COVID. It's a totally unrelated complaint of the president's.
Well, the president has also been really pushing Congress, or he said, in fact, publicly, that Congress will consider not only raising the amount of the stimulus check to $2,000, but Congress will also consider the fraudulent election. And that doesn't look like it's going to be likely considered by Congress either. I mean, first of all, it's been not even in any way corroborated that this was a fraudulent election.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was an interesting signing statement from the president, because he tried to cast it as something that he got in exchange for signing the massive $2.3 trillion bill. But that was kind of a non-binding request. You know, there's nothing that makes Congress agree to any of that. And the House is led by Democrats. So, you know, not really expecting to see any kind of concrete action on the things that the president is trying to cast as a win.
And again, Anna Edgerton with us from Bloomberg, and also Kimberly Atkins is with us, senior opinion writer for the Boston Globe. And Kimberly, I'm interested in getting you on record here of what you call the pardon palooza, which is we're still sorting out the pardons that the president granted, not only to those convicted under the Mueller investigation, but also we're talking about Blackwater criminals, murderers, really, I suppose, in terms of the convictions, and also corrupt politicians, including Duncan Hunter here in California, who were also convicted. I mean, what's the, from your perspective, the effect of all of this?
Yes, well, it's a continuation of what we've seen from President Trump in being very transactional in terms of the way that he has governed, and that it includes protecting people who he sees as protecting him, people who have defended him politically, as well as, you know, certain causes celebre for the conservative base that he is trying to please. And I think you have both the members of Congress who were charged or convicted of felonies being on that list, including members of Congress, and also the Blackwater pardons, which were particularly you know, really shocking in a way, because these are people who were essentially convicted of war crimes for killing innocent civilians.
Including children.
Including children in Iraq. But in some of the circles, online circles of those who support the president, they were known as the Biden Four. And so Donald Trump called them great patriots and painted this as an undoing of some sort of injustice instead of really pardoning war criminals, which is what essentially it is. And look, it lays a groundwork, especially when you're talking about the father of his son-in-law, Charles Kushner, as well as others. It lays a groundwork for what a lot of people expect him to try to preemptively pardon even members of his own family, including Jared Kushner, or his children, Ivanka or others, or even pardon himself. There is a lot of question as to whether he has the constitutional authority to do that, but he has already stated that he believes that he can. So this seems to me, it feels to me like a lead up to what could really be extending that transactional approach that he has taken to pardons and commutations, which with respect to everyone except himself, he has an absolute right to do legally. But politically, it looks like the opposite of what he claimed he was coming into Washington to do, which is drain the swamp.
Well, I also noticed your paper had an editorial about the burden to concede on the election falling on the shoulders of Vice President Pence to restore public trust and assault on American democracy is how the editorial read. What are the chances from your perspective of that being likely to happen?
Little to none, and the members of the board were aware of this. But at the same time, we thought it was important to point out that that Vice President Mike Pence, as someone who was on the ticket with Donald Trump that lost in 2020, is in a position to concede. He's the only other person besides Donald Trump who was in the position to say, we fought hard, but Joe Biden and Kamala Harris won. And that's that, even if Donald Trump won't. But also, Vice President Pence, as an elected official, he was on the ticket in 2016, is the only person in the White House that Donald Trump cannot fire. And so while others may be too afraid of standing up to him for fear of being humiliated or losing their job, as even Attorney General Barr did in the end, even though he was one of Donald Trump's biggest defenders, he wouldn't say that the election was rigged and that cost him his job in the end in an unceremonious way. He can't take Mike Pence's job away. He will always be a vice president or a former vice president after January 20th. So he's in a unique position, even if it's unlikely he will use that position to do what we see as the right thing.
Well, Mike Pence has to save his own political reputation and possibly maybe eyeing a run for the presidency himself. So all of this at least can follow a possible trajectory. But I think you're right in your assessment of zero to none. Let me invite listeners to join this conversation again if you have thoughts about the federal stimulus bill or questions. And what do you think of these pardons and actions in the final weeks in the White House by President Trump? You can give us a call now. We invite you to do that and be part of the program. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Talking with Kimberly Atkins, Anna Edgerton, and Ron Elving, and you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the latest national political news with Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News, Kimberly Atkins, senior opinion writer with the Boston Globe, and Bloomberg editor Anna Edgerton. And you can be part of the program if you have some thoughts or if you have some questions. We invite you to join us now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. The number again for your calls, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you may have to forum@kqed.org. Ron, let me go back to you, Ron Elving. What about, we didn't even talk about this, but I think it's an important part of the whole picture of national politics, veto of the unrelated defense bill, which essentially has a lot of bipartisan concern.
There are few, if any, bills that are more bipartisan in Congress every year than the National Defense Authorization Act. And this is a staple. It's a standby. It is absolutely something that the military counts on. It's the authorization of every program that our armed forces are carrying out, everything the Department of Defense does. It is not the only bill that affects them, because there's also a funding bill for them. But this is their authorization to operate. And it's been passed every year for 59 years in a row. And this is about as bipartisan as it gets. As I say, it was run out of the House Armed Services Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee by a Democrat in the House and a Republican in the Senate. Jim Inhofe of Tulsa, Oklahoma, who is a very conservative Republican senator, was the father of the bill on the Senate side. And the president vetoed it. And he vetoed it, saying that what he was really upset about here was the Section 230 of the Communications Act of 1996, which we all know of as basically social media. Facebook, Twitter, all of those platforms that we all use rely on this section because it gives them liability protection against things that may be said on the platform that they can't stand behind and prove the way publishers are required to do. So this is a big deal to the president because he feels he's been treated unfairly by social media, Facebook, Twitter, and he is at war with them. And he thinks that this would be a way to bring them down, if you will, rein them in. And by the way, there are quite a few people who feel that this section gives those platforms way too much protection and allows people to do things on those platforms that are really inimical to society. A lot of misinformation, a lot of disinformation, a lot of conspiracy theories, and even the organizing of violence. So there are reasons to talk about Section 230, but they're not necessarily the reasons that President Trump is relying upon in calling for it to be abolished, to be removed from the law. So that doesn't have anything to do with the National Defense Authorization Act, but the president has vetoed this bill to get some attention to his 230 campaign. We assume it will be either overridden or repassed in the new Congress. But they could get it overridden even this week, perhaps as soon in the Senate as tomorrow. But it's also possible that it'll be kicked over until the new Congress convenes early in January.
We're also talking about salaries of those in the military, which the president at least says that he is all in favor of. And as a champion of what the military needs, and particularly those who serve in the armed services, I'm wondering, if I can go back to you, Kimberly Atkins, on this, he also was objecting to removal of Confederate base names.
Yes. Again, this is another play to the president's base. He has claimed that the protests that we have seen this year after the death of George Floyd, the killing of George Floyd, which have included calling for Confederate monuments to come down in the Capitol itself. Just last week, I believe, the statue of Robert E. Lee that represented Virginia was taken down. And we've seen that happening across the country. Well, the president has really rallied against this, saying that it's an attempt to remove history. He cast these people as heroes, even though they were literally fighting against the United States. And so he inconsistent with that, he opposes efforts to rename bases that were named after Confederate heroes. Again, a play to his base, but something that even folks like his former UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, led the removal and called for the removal of statues in South Carolina, where she was a former governor. So it's not completely in line with all Republicans, but it is keeping with Donald Trump's messaging.
And Ann Edgerton, if I go back to you, a lot of this omnibus bill includes $1.4 trillion to fund the government through September. But I'd like listeners to know, actually, I've sort of been cursory about what's in the bill, and there's a lot in this bill, and maybe we could flesh it out a bit with you. We're talking about $300 a week in jobless benefits, and those who make $75,000 a year or less getting a $600 stimulus check, which, as we've said, at least the Democrats are trying to up to 2,000, excuse me. But what else is in the bill? Can you break it down for us, Anna?
Yeah, and that's one reason why it was so important to sign this bill into law this week, is because there's kind of a web of deadlines coming up with some expiring pandemic relief from the previous bill that was passed in March. You know, we talked about the eviction moratorium, the federal eviction moratorium that would run out on December 31st. There's $15 billion in aid for airlines that, of course, have been greatly impacted by the pandemic. There's, I believe, $285 billion for the Paycheck Protection Program, which is a program that gives forgivable loans to small businesses with less than 500 employees. And in the government spending, the $1.4 trillion that you mentioned, this is just normal funding for federal agencies. And without that funding being signed into law before midnight today, we would have had a government shutdown starting tomorrow. So, you know, it's good that Congress doesn't have to scramble to pass additional, another temporary funding measure, and the federal agencies will be funded through the end of the fiscal year on September 30th.
And Ron Elving, what about these rescissions that the president is demanding under the Impoundment Control Act of 1974? I mean, he wants to redline, essentially, doesn't he?
Yes, it's a little bit like the line item veto that presidents have sometimes called for. Back to Ronald Reagan, give me the line item veto and I'll give you a balanced budget. Of course, presidents don't propose balanced budgets either, but then they ask for the power to just line items out. And so what Donald Trump is saying here is, I want all this spending held up. Things such as aid to the Kennedy Center or aid to various and sundry commissions. Even though in his own budget that came out from his own people earlier this year, he oftentimes had even larger amounts for all these same things. He also wants to go after foreign aid to certain countries, Belize, for example, and he wants to knock that down. Now, the only thing he can do, because federal law does not permit the president to actually line item veto anything, the only thing he can do is call attention to them and ask Congress to eliminate that spending. And he can also delay its effectuation by 45 days. So that's what his redlining procedure amounts to. It's another gesture, as so much of what he's been doing in recent days, from the naming of military bases after Confederate generals to how much money we're going to give to supporting the Kennedy Center. A lot of this is just symbolic action because he has not been consistent in his own position on some of these things, particularly with regard to spending. So this is a way, I think, to cover for his unhappiness, which is really with the Republican Party's unwillingness to get in line behind him and call this election somehow illegal or fraudulent or not official. And he is continuing to tweet about this and insist that somehow on January 6th, when Congress certifies the results from the electors who voted in all 50 states and the District of Columbia, to act as though that is in some sense or another a review of the election results that could in some sense or another be reversed. There is no such authority. And it is a formality that on January 6th, the Congress certifies the results from the electors in the states who are actually responsible for choosing the next president. But the president continues to act as though that's some kind of last chance for him to stay in the presidency. And because the Republican Party hasn't lined up behind him on that, a few have, yes, but not the party formally, not the leaders of the party. He is unhappy with them, and that seems to have driven an awful lot of his behavior over the last couple of 3 weeks.
Yeah, he seems to be particularly unhappy, it would seem, with Leader McConnell, who did certainly compliment him for signing the bill, but did not mention anything about all those red line items or wasteful items or pork, as he's called them, that he had once agreed to. Let me bring a caller on, and we'll bet Wynn on as our first caller. Wynn, good morning.
Morning. Thank you. The federal government can cover their overages on their budget by borrowing money or issuing bonds, but the cities, counties, and states can't do that, and they're going to be forced to lay off an awful lot of people. Are there any provisions in the current laws that are being passed right now or expected that are going to help the states, cities, and counties with their problem?
Yeah, good and important question. Kimberly Atkins, can I go to you on that?
Sure. Yes. The short answer is no. That was one of the sticking points between Republicans and Democrats. Republicans and Donald Trump were set against giving money to cities and towns. Donald Trump messaged that he didn't want to reward these Democratic-run and blue cities and states with money from the federal government. But of course, as we point out, this bill keeps the lights on for the federal government, yet does not give any help to these cities and towns to help keep their lights on. They're being devastated by budget cuts. It's leading to the loss of jobs in the middle of a recession, in the middle of a pandemic, and it's really devastating. Now, the bill does have some funding for schools and for infrastructure for schools, including internet access, since so many students are working remotely. And it also has some funding to help with distribution of the vaccine, which has run into some hiccups, which is something that will aid local municipalities indirectly, but no direct funding.
Well, a question related to that, Kimberly, from Richard, who wants to know why the Republican opposition to state and local government assistance. Isn't there a risk of cuts to police staffing?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why some Democrats are saying that it is actually Republicans who are defunding police, not Democrats, because a lot of this funding is going to first responders. Cities and towns are having a very difficult time with their budgets, and many states and some localities, by law, they have to balance their budget. They can't run on deficits the way that the federal government can. And the only place to go a lot of these times are layoffs and furloughs. So it's really costing people their jobs. It's costing cities the ability to react to this pandemic, continue to have a strong response to this pandemic. So it's really problematic. It is something that Republicans were against, or they tried to sort of trade on this in response to liability limits for companies. Based on suits that come out of that stem from the pandemic, something that was a non-starter for Democrats and really had nothing to do with emergency funding. So it ended up at the end of the day, there was no resolution on that. And so this bill, as expected, really is without that.
Kimberly Atkins, again, is senior opinion writer for the Boston Globe. Read a comment. We talked with Kimberly Atkins before about pardons, and a listener writes, regarding Trump's final days in office, his pardons, etc., I have no doubt he is surrounded by a circle of minions looking for anything and everything he can do that is entirely within his power. I would not be at the least surprised by family pardons, a self-pardon, pardons in advance for crimes yet to be committed, funding for a Washington, D.C. monument in his honor, etc. And here's a comment. Let me go to you on this, Ann Edgerton, from a listener named Matthew. Actually, it's a question more than a comment. He says, I'm a 63-year-old unemployed man in Sonoma County, currently on my second extension for 20 weeks due to expire in 1 month. According to the latest news, my benefit period was cut yesterday to 13 weeks, which means I'm out of funds on my claim now. What are the prospects for restoring the 7 weeks that were just taken away and for extending the benefit period beyond 59 weeks total, as happened during the 2008 recession?
Yeah, there are a lot of unemployed people who are in a very difficult situation right now. And, you know, in addition to the shorter time to extend these benefits, there are a lot of people who haven't been able to get any benefits at all because state unemployment offices have been so overrun, they just can't keep up with the requests and haven't been able to process those. But, you know, what is included in this most recent bill that was signed into law yesterday, there's a $300 supplemental unemployment benefit for, I believe it's 11 weeks through mid-March. So that's in addition to state benefits. There's also federal benefits for gig workers, which was not included in previous unemployment packages. So, you know, there is some support there, but we're seeing that, you know, depending on how long this pandemic and the closures that have resulted, depending on how long all that lasts, you know, could need to be refreshed or extended in order to get the economy into a calmer seas.
Looking at another email from a listener named Daniel, who says the stimulus bill was a loyalty test, but it didn't work this time. For the first time, his Republican sycophants blew him off. Maybe Trump thought he was still relevant. The real question, Ron Elving, comes down to politically, why, I suppose, whatever we can deconstruct from this, the president was at odds with his fellow Republicans. He really wasn't even part of the negotiations.
not personally. And had he been personally part of the negotiations, we are told he would have insisted on this $2,000 stimulus check all along. It's difficult to see how we would get the ball over the line with a $2,000 check in there, because that adds $350 or more billion dollars to the bill. If we take the bill up from $2,000, from $600 stimulus checks to $2,000, that adds a lot of cost. And a lot of the Republicans are objecting to that cost. And many of them had dug in their heels and said, look, if it's going over $1 trillion, I'm not with you. I don't care where it's going. I don't want this bill to cost more than $1 trillion, especially in the Senate, but in the House as well. In the Senate, where it really mattered, there are about half of the Republican senators who were saying, we don't really want another huge bill. We might take a few hundred billion. And I know that sounds pretty huge in and of itself, but relative to what we had seen back in the spring.
Remember, Everett Dirksen, what's a billion here or there, right?
Yeah. Now we're talking about, you know, a trillion here, a trillion there. Now you're really talking about real money, to paraphrase Everett Dirksen. So let's give them the principle that the government ultimately does have to come up with this money somehow, and it's all being done by borrowing it. There are no new taxes or any other new sources of revenue in any of this. It's all borrowing. It's all going on to future generations of American taxpayers. So the Republicans have a principle there. They also have a real fear of going back to their voters, whom they promised fiscal responsibility, and saying, well, we just passed another multi-trillion dollar bill. And for relief, completely unpaid for. And that is why many of them have been objecting. So there is that split between the president and his own party. They are not on the same page about how much money to send out in these stimulus checks. If the president had been involved all along instead of sending Steve Mnuchin to do his negotiating for him, we might have seen a different process, or we might have seen simply no relief bill at all, which was where we were until just a few weeks ago.
Well, we're coming up on a break here, but I'd be interested in hearing, Kimberly Atkins, what you have to say about how all this is going to affect the election coming up in Georgia.
Well, yes, it's already been an issue with Donald Trump, his focus alone on the election and claiming fraud, and also Republicans trying to encourage people to actually go out and vote. But we have seen the Republicans in those races saying, trying to message that, look, we brought home these stimulus checks for you. We voted in favor of this relief to bring you this stimulus in a way to try to hold on to their seats. But at the same time, you have Donald Trump calling it a meager amount and pushing for a larger amount that, again, undercuts that messaging as Republicans are trying to hold on to the upper chamber.
All right. As I said, we are coming up on a break, but we do want to hear your thoughts. And you can let us know what you think about the stimulus bill or what you think about the pardons and actions in the final weeks in the White House during this lame duck period by President Trump. Call us, 866-733-6786 is the number for your calls. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or join us by Twitter or Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, talking with Kimberly Atkins of the Boston Globe, Anna Edgerton of Bloomberg, and Ron Elving of NPR. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about national politics. I want to read an email from a listener named Randy who writes, I think these last days prove as much as ever that Donald Trump is unfit to be president. These 4 years have shown weaknesses in our system that need to be fixed. I think we need constitutional amendments to put safeguards on the pardon power, and we need either amendments or laws to reduce the ability of the party and power to prevent legislation from coming to the floor of either body. These institutions are surprisingly undemocratic when it comes to control by the party and power. And I should mention that tomorrow we're going to be talking with a couple of law professors, Bob Bauer and Jack Goldsmith, during this hour, who have written a book called After Trump, in which they make a number of concrete suggestions, actually recommendations, that are all viable from their perspective and plausible in terms of changing the power of the presidency from things that we've learned as a result of these 4 years of the Trump administration. Let me bring a caller on here. Chuck, join us. Good morning. Chuck, are you with us? Well, we'll try to get Chuck involved. Let me get another caller on here.
Michael,
you're there. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Now I can.
I was on, but wasn't connected. Anyway, let's assume for purpose of my question that Trump, after he leaves office, is not indicted for any federal crimes, or perhaps, you know, his self-pardon stands in the light of day. But so he's still subject to state prosecutions. My question is, does your panel know of any particular crimes that he might be charged with by one or more states? I think tax evasion may be one of them, but are there any others that he might be vulnerable to?
Well, right now, the New York district attorney has been working on this for quite some time, not only Cyrus Vance, but a couple of offices in New York State. Kimberly Atkins, want to comment?
Yes, that's absolutely right. There are investigations that are active, based out of New York is the primary one that is looking at President Trump through. It could be anything that could involve taxes. It can involve campaign finance violations. I take that back. That's federal, but it can involve tax evasions. There's certainly a lot of things involving the Trump Organization that could be looked at. We've already seen actions taken against his charity, his foundation that was meant to close down based on rules that they were breaking. And there could be things that are under investigation that we simply do not know yet. But the caller is absolutely right that any self-pardon, if that does pass constitutional muster, or if Joe Biden chooses not to make that a priority, prosecuting his potential federal crimes, I should say that the incoming attorney general doesn't make it a priority to investigate him, he still faces considerable potential liability. And I just want to clarify something that another listener said about pardons for crimes not yet committed. The president can't do that. The president has very broad pardon power, but he can't give folks an open-ended get out of jail free card. But he can issue pardons very broadly in a way for crimes that have not yet been charged. So for any particular period of time or issued in a very general way, which could protect people close to him, again, his children or other people who are political allies.
Well, one thing that I should mention, since I already promoted tomorrow's program with Bob Bauer and Jack Goldsmith, who served in different administrations, that's a bipartisan co-authorship of their book, After Trump. They take different sides in terms of whether or not the president should be held to the rule of law after he leaves office, or it should be pursued, in fact, to prosecute him. And that should be an interesting debate. But as I said, they also have a lot of concrete recommendations about the power of the presidency. And in fact, another listener says, how damaging may it be to our democracy? This is Robert, who writes, if the president and his criminal family are not held accountable for all of the illegal acts they perpetrated. Here's a question from Kent. Ann Edgerton, let me go to you with this question from Kent. He says, is Trump's objective in blocking the defense bill really about the naming of bases and internet regulations, or is his real objective the provisions that require the disclosure of the identity of owners of shell companies? Example, Kushner is used in conjunction with campaign money.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And that's an exercise that we do often, is try to figure out Trump's complaints for some of his actions. But, you know, it's a massive bill. You know, it's more than $700 billion. And there are a lot of provisions that are included because it is a must-pass bill. So lawmakers from both parties know that this is a piece of legislation that's leaving the station, and it becomes the vehicle for other provisions that people want to include. So there's a lot in there. And, you know, Trump publicly identified these two things that we've talked about, the bases named for members of the Confederacy, as well as the fact that the bill doesn't include revision of the Section 230 liability protection for technology companies. But, you know, he could have other motivations. It's always a bit of a guessing game to figure out what is behind Trump's actions.
Let me ask you about something else, Anna, and that is there is in this omnibus bill money for, well, funding for vaccine distribution. And what is that going to amount to? Do we know at this point?
Right. So, you know, we have the National Defense Authorization Act now talking about the omnibus bill, which includes the pandemic relief. There are some funds for vaccine distribution. And this is one thing that was really important for Democrats to include because they didn't get the $160 billion for state and local governments. They tried to direct funds to localities in different ways, you know, more funds for education, more funds for vaccine distribution, because a lot of this burden will fall on local leaders. So, you know, it's important that they have the support they need to make sure that we get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible.
And we'll bring some more callers aboard here. Let's go to Sid next. Sid, thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Sorry, do we have Sid? Shirley. Okay, Shirley. Go ahead. Sorry, Shirley. I didn't mean to call you Sid.
Right.
Go ahead, please.
No worries. I've been called worse. Is the help for renters that is there help for renters that are not in federal housing units? And if so, where would I find that? I've been looking at the CDC websites and the 211.org website and also the local government website, and all of the help that's listed are for only people that are federally supported housing units, because the assumption that I get from the COVID bill is that they're trying to provide rental relief for people who are behind on their rent payments, and I was hoping that would be for non-government housing or federally supported housing people as well.
Can you help us here, Anna Edgerton?
You know, I'll have to look up that specific provision, and I'll try to do that while we're still on the air. But, you know, that was one of the discussions that they had in the final days of negotiation, was whether or not the eviction moratorium was necessary, since there is support for renters as well. So that was one thing that Republicans had questioned, and Democrats were able to include both the eviction moratorium extension and the aid for renters. So I'm going to try to look up right now whether or not that includes who exactly that applies to.
Well, thank you for looking it up diligently, and we'll see if we can come to an answer for Shirley before we dismiss this program and say goodbye to everybody. I'm actually looking at some emails that are just floating in here. Here's Roberto, who says, it is disingenuous to pretend that the GOP doesn't want to give $2,000 checks to citizens because of conservatism. It ignores the multiple billions being given to military contractors and favored foreign governments. The $2,000 per person is paltry compared to what other developed nations have done during the pandemic, and we can afford more than any of them. I think, Ron Elving, let's get you to weigh in here. I mean, the fact of the matter is that all this conservatism about money and Mitch McConnell talking about socialism as a way of spending money that shouldn't be spent, using that word or that signifier, if you will, does kind of beg the question in terms of not only the deficit that's being run up here, but also, you know, there are certain things that have come through this Congress that have been Republican-led, not only in terms of tax breaks, but also in terms of three martini lunch breaks and things like that.
The three martini lunch break, that was a Donald Trump special. He insisted on having that in this most recent package that we've been talking about, because he sees that, he says, as a stimulus for the restaurant industry, which certainly can use some help. It's actually not just for martinis. It's for business luncheons that can be written off as long as you can convince the IRS that you're talking about business. And there's a long tradition of that being in the tax code, and Donald Trump missed it, even though he's not really much of a martini guy himself. That, though, I think is symbolic of what we have seen in terms of the concurrent Republican majority in the Senate and the Republican majority in the House that lasted for the first 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency. They tried to repeal Obamacare, but failing that, they did manage to pass a highly significant tax cut, the vast majority of benefits of which have gone to the highest income levels in our economy. So they were willing to accept blowing a big hole in the budget in the sense of not paying for all of those tax breaks, as long as they were tax breaks and they could justify it by saying they were stimulating the economy. They were also stimulating a better income level for many of their own constituents. So this talk of what is fiscally responsible and not responsible is always tied to how people feel about where that money is going, if they support sending that money to purchase weapons for Saudi Arabia. Okay, then maybe that's all right, and you can blow a hole in the federal budget to do that. Whereas talking about another $350 billion to boost the stimulus checks from $600 to $2,000 gives some of those same people the vapors.
Well, I wonder, Kimberly Atkins, with your opinion writing, how you might respond to a listener who writes, the stinginess of Republicans can be explained by one thing. They don't want the Biden administration to be successful in reviving the economy.
I think that's quite a possibility. Certainly, Donald Trump is acting, seems to be acting not only out of an interest to deny the results of the election, but in the administration's attempt to not allow the incoming administration to get briefings, for example, seems to be a way of trying to set it up to fail if possible. And Republicans certainly are not trying to help. I mean, recall that it was Mitch McConnell who said in 2008 or 2009 in the incoming Obama administration that his number one job was to make sure that then President Obama would be a one-term president. So obstruction is something that the Republicans have really openly practiced in terms of political strategy, and there's no reason to believe that they're not equally motivated now.
And again, Kimberly Atkins is senior opinion writer for the Boston Globe, and here's Jim joining us from Atlanta. Jim, you're on the air. Good morning.
You're on the air. Yeah, quick comment. Here in Georgia, the stimulus bill support by the Republican senators is getting very little play. They're busy accusing Ossoff and Reverend Warnock of being somehow being communist, anti-everything American. But my question is this. If Trump should pardon his family members and others, can't they be compelled to testify since they were in a federal trial for others and reveal information since they can't claim the Fifth, since they can't self-incriminate?
I think that's right, isn't it, Ron Elving?
That is my impression as well. Now, I am not a lawyer, but my impression is that you cannot claim the Fifth if you do not have any exposure. So if you have been pardoned, you cannot say that you can't testify because you would incriminate yourself because it's impossible for you to do so.
And here's Deanne who says, I've read that language in the current relief bill states direct deposits and checks to individuals can't be dispersed after January 15, 2021, and those whose relief money isn't sent by then must follow up with the IRS when they file 2020 taxes. Is that still the case? And if so, that ultimately means that a lot of people who need the funds now aren't going to receive them. The IRS states their Get My Payment page is offline so people can no longer sign up for direct deposit. Can you help us here, Ann Edgerton?
Yeah, there should still be time for the Treasury to get those payments out. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin had said that the IRS is better set up now to get those payments after they already had a first round in the CARES Act. Those passed in March. So that infrastructure is already up and running and those checks should go out pretty quickly. It is more complicated for people who don't have a direct deposit already on file with the IRS. So there are different ways to recoup those payments if you believe that you are owed those and haven't received them yet.
Ann Edgerton, again, is an editor with Bloomberg. And I wonder, Kimberly Atkins, if you would let us know what your thoughts are about something that we have here from Thomas, a listener who writes, how have Trump's biggest supporters on the right and the far right news outlets spun his temporary torpedoing of the relief bill last week? I'm curious what they thought of the $2,000 Trump wanted to send out.
Yes, well, it's interesting. I don't know precisely how the right-leaning news organizations have handled his change on the $2,000 funding, but we are seeing in general this shift by people who are followers of the president, his most loyal followers, away even from Fox News, which was for a while portrayed essentially as a state-sanctioned network, news network for Donald Trump, when they began doing things like, for example, calling the election for Joe Biden and not reporting in a completely sycophantic way, you see a lot of people turning instead to very right-leaning news networks like Newsmax or OANN, which the president even promoted, and he chastised Fox News. So you're seeing this selective news consumption as a big issue and frankly, a big problem in fomenting the political and other divisions we are seeing in the country. And I think that's something that will continue into 2021.
And Ron Alving, here's Lori, who wants to know, please ask what the bill does to curb abuses of the payroll protection program in the first and second rounds. Is there anything in the bill to actually get money targeted to small businesses?
I can't tell you what exactly is in there that would do that and whether it would be effective or not. This is a concern, and it was one of the things that the negotiators were working on to get the final language in this foot-thick bill. If you printed it all out onto paper, it is a foot thick. In those guts, there are going to be many things that then have to be worked out by people in the administration, regulators, people who write the regulations for administering it. And one believes, at least, that the Republican negotiators were as interested in getting those funds out to small businesses and the people who had been concerned about how the Small Business Administration was handling this, because many of them are their supporters.
Yeah. I'm not hearing anything.
Hello. Michael, can you still hear me?
Yeah, now I can. I was completely blank there for a number of
seconds.
Okay,
I had nothing there for a moment or two either. I couldn't hear you.
Well, now we can hear each other, so hallelujah.
I'm very sorry, Michael.
No, well, it's not your fault. I don't know what went wrong there, but we'll see if we can indeed figure out what went wrong. I'm just wondering, as we come up toward the end of this hour, if there's any speculation. For example, here's Craig who says, what's the possibility of Trump resigning a day before Biden is sworn in and then Pence becomes acting president and does the Gerald Ford and pardons Trump and his whole family? You know, the one thing I think we've learned, and maybe go to you on this, Kimberly Adkins, about this Trump presidency is it's almost impossible to predict what he's going to do or not do.
Yes, and we saw in the past week was a great example of that, where even Republicans didn't know when it came to the defense spending bill or the omnibus with the coronavirus relief, what he was going to do at any point. If you spoke to someone, they didn't know. It was really chaotic, where Donald Trump was intervening at times, but really not a part of the process. He didn't have any daily schedule. He went off to Mar-a-Lago, and it was even more difficult and chaotic.
Gotta leave it there. I'm sorry to say thank you, Kimberly Adkins. Thank you, Ann Edgerton. And thank you, Ron Elving. And thank you, our listeners. And please stay safe. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.